Hello and welcome to Baseball Barbacast, the only baseball podcast in the world that puts the family in Cespedes Family Barbecue. I'm Jordan Schusterman. I am not Jake Mintz, as you can probably tell if you've listened to this show before. My dear friend Jake is still in the mountains of France, which sounds like a lie because I realized when I was gone, he was making jokes about me being climbing, you know, Mount Everest and stuff. But no, he is indeed in France on vacation. But the podcast rolls on, and I wanted to bring in another special guest host. And you know, everybody knows that baseball is a world full of nepotism, and I decided to keep that trend going by bringing in my younger brother, David Schusterman, to co-host this podcast with me. We think you'll enjoy it, but David, welcome to the show. It is so good to see you. How are you on this fine Monday morning?
It's great to be here. I am actually climbing Mount Everest, unlike you. A poser, a coward.
Yeah.
I'm a fraud. I'm amidst the climb. Yes.
Okay. Well, it's so good that your cell service is as good as I imagine could possibly hope for as you make that climb. I hope you're staying warm. But yeah, so we decided to bring my brother in to have him pinch pod here because mostly because one of the bigger stories over the past few days involves his beloved Washington Nationals. And the second half of the show, we are going to bring on Jesse Dougherty of the Washington Post to talk about the latest and not so greatest from Steven Strasburg, one of the sadder stories we have in baseball, but also one of the most fascinating. And David, as a longtime Nationals fan, I'm sure we'll have some thoughts about that. So we're going to bring on Jesse in the second half, but first half of the show will be pretty standard. We're going to talk about the ball that happened this weekend. I know I was certainly watching a lot of college baseball and college softball over the weekend because this is prime time for those seasons. If you want to hear, you know, my thoughts on those things, I'm going to save it for the Shock Factor podcast with our good friend Stephen Shock. So we encourage you to go check that out. But David, first of all, before we get into the action of the weekend, like, we should introduce you a little bit, because if you're just listening and you say, "Oh wow, Jordan's a brother. Oh wow, okay." Like, who are you? How old are you? What is your occupation? What are your baseball credentials?
Yeah, I'm a 21 year old. I'm 6.5 years younger than Jordan. Mm-hmm. So that's always been fun growing up in his shadow. No, that's not quite. I'm my own person. But I go to the University of Maryland, who just suffered a terrible defeat at the hands of George Mason. So they're out in their regional, but that's okay. They were going to lose to Wake Forest anyways. I'm a big Nationals fan. It's been a weird ride since the 2019 World Series, but you know, we'll get to that later. Yes. And that's pretty much my ball watching extent for the most part. Although I do tune on to the MLB TV a good amount.
You know. Oh, yeah. And also, again, the thing I say, first of all, that 6.5 year difference is a very big difference and a very relevant difference as far as Nationals fanhood, right? Fandom.
Yes.
Because we obviously grew up in the same house, but because I was a little bit older and because the Nats were so bad, in my consciousness, I didn't attach to them in the same way. Whereas David, by the time he was kind of becoming a baseball fan, it was like the Nationals were good and cool and fun. So he much more reasonably latched on, and it paid off in tremendous fashion in 2019.
Oh, yes.
We'll talk more about that later. But the truth is, too, is that David also is much more of a basketball fan. So I don't know if you wanted to come talk about, you know, the you know, Denver's pick and roll defense in game two or whatever, but I haven't been grinding tape like a lot of NBA dorks over the past 12 hours. So I think we're going to save that for probably off the podcast. Is that okay?
That's okay. That's for my podcast.
Okay. That's for all the pods that you're going to listen to this week. All right. So let's get to the baseball from the weekend that was. We, as always, are going to review the sweeps, the series wins, the splits, and the bizarre series that are going to Monday. Some very strange scheduling going on across the league. But David has apparently done some level of preparation, so I'm looking forward to finding out what that is. But we are going to begin by reviewing the results from the weekend. 5 sweeps over the weekend, another mop possibly to be finished on Monday. Our five sweeps, the Pirates over the Cardinals, the Rangers over the Mariners. Oh, God, the Mariners stink. The Blue Jays over the Mets in New York. Very impressive. Marlins over the A's. No huge surprise there. And the White Sox in emphatic fashion sweeping the Detroit Tigers. That AL Central really getting quite spicy. Pittsburgh over St. Louis. Every time we think, okay, here we go. St. Louis going to get right back in it. A lot of tension on the Reds and the Brewers because, oh, can the Reds overtake the Brewers? Well, instead, the Brewers take three from the Reds, and the Pirates are like, hey, Cardinals, you're going to be staying in last place. We got Cabrian Hayes hitting homers. We got O'Neill Cruz handing out his own bobblehead. The vibes in Pittsburgh were immaculate, and it is cool to see the Pirates hanging around.
Yeah, so I just want to take a quick victory lap here. As a Pirates ball knower, preseason, I came into the season with one bold prediction in my bold predictions that are posted nowhere for no one to see besides Jordan. And that is that the Pirates were going to finish second place in the National League Central. And that is looking like a spicy, good take right now.
It was looking even better, you know, in April. And then they were one of the worst teams in baseball in May. And then now they look amazing in June. So it's going to be a wild ride for you. It's going to be a wild ride for Buccos fans. I just want to ask you, like, at the time, you know, David's thrown me all kinds of crazy takes over the years. As he mentions, only I'm the only one responsible for holding him accountable because he does not have a Twitter account with that many followers and he doesn't really tweet very much. So I just want to review why I don't totally understand. What was it rooted in? At the time,
I will be honest. A good amount of it was O'Neill Cruz. Right. So that has not exactly panned out, unfortunately. But I don't know. I just believed in the Buccos.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll see how that pans out. But yeah, I mean, the Cardinals just can't get out of their own way. We know Steven Matz has finally been bumped from the rotation. It is nice to see that. Not that I'm, you know, rooting against, but more so to see Matthew Liberatore really get a chance to kind of show what he has, because there's very little like bona fide upside in the Cardinals pitching, but Liberatore represents that. Michaelis has also been better. The other interesting thing from that series was Albert Pujols was on TV. I didn't get to watch too much of that, but he was on the Sunday morning Peacock broadcast. And I didn't see any clips coming out where people were making fun of Albert. So I assume he did just fine, but that was certainly interesting to see Pujols in a suit. calling games. That was kind of funny.
Yeah, no, I would not have imagined that he would go that path in his career, but I'm glad to see it. It's a good call.
Another guy like that where it's just like he can but hey, there's a lot of examples like that where it's like you would assume they could just go hang out and instead they're like, oh, screw it. I feel like most of them want to like give it a try and then just find out if they enjoy it. I feel like that's what happened there. Rangers over Mariners. I mean, listen, the Rangers are just a flat-out better team. Their offense is legitimately elite. They have gotten so much good starting pitching, of course, from some of the guys they acquired. And the bullpen is not good, but it is good enough when you're scoring this many runs. And the Mariners' offense sucks. And, you know, they threw Brian Wu to the fire there, straight from AA. And I think he still has a bright future. But him and Bryce Miller, you know, that's against one of the best lineups in the league. You know, that's going to happen. So Mariners have a lot of work to do playing San Diego coming up this week in a two-game stretch. All right, Toronto over the Mets. This is one where Toronto was also a team kind of a bit of a mess recently. Again, when you're in the AL East and you are playing well, it doesn't really matter. You have to be playing more than just pretty well. You have to be really, really, really good. And to go into New York and be like, hey, the AL East is way better than the NL East, in case you didn't know. And Mets struggling. What were your takeaways from this series, David?
I just think the biggest thing is that I think the Blue Jays are turning it on. I think they are getting hot. I think they are going to be in second place by the end of June. I don't think they're going to catch the Rays, but I think they are going to get. I think they're going to get going here.
Okay. They have a pretty tough schedule coming up, but maybe they will rise to that. Now, again, the challenge with Toronto is that they have been terrible against their own division. They've been great against everybody else. And the other challenge is that they only have two series against AL East opponents in the next like 2 months, which is kind of weird. So it's going to be harder for them to gain ground. It's going to have to be more about the other teams kind of falling back. But, you know, as we sit here on Monday, they're 8.5 back of Tampa, so we can move that aside. But 4.5 back of the Orioles, 2.5 back from the Yankees, still in fourth place. But getting some separation there from Boston, definitely good to see. And yeah, they're 33-27. They'd be in first place in both central divisions, of course, and in probably at least closer to first in many of the other ones.
And just a quick note on the Mets here. For all those Mets Twitter people clamoring for Mark Vientos to be the DH over Daniel Vogelbach, Mark Vientos' OPS starts with a 4. Ooh. Daniel Vogelbach gets on base. Ooh. So that's all I have to say there.
Oh,
but he's got future. He's got a bright future.
We'll get to if you're like, why is David standing for Daniel Vogelbach? We'll explain that in a little bit here. We move to the next sweep, the Marlins over the A's. I mean, whatever, you sweep the A's, what's the big deal? Luis Arraez, what a treat. This dude's hitting over 390 now. I think he had a 5-hit game on Friday or Saturday, game-winning hit on Sunday. He is so delightful. I don't give a shit what his Statcast sliders look like. He is so much fun. He is entirely his own category of hitter. And if you can't appreciate that, I cannot help you.
Luis Arraez, going to hit 390 this year. Gene Segura, going to hit 190 this year.
I'm not sure. What is more likely, that Gene Segura can get to 190 or that Luis Arraez can be down? Where is Segura at right now? Because he has...
I think he might be at 190 now.
Is he at 190? Because he has zero homers, so I know he has the lowest... He has one of the lowest... He definitely has the lowest OPS, one of the lowest WRC pluses in like the last 30 years for a guy playing every day. Okay, he's hitting 191. Okay, so... Is it
maybe so? He's pretty great, is what it sounds like.
Yeah, 191, 258, 219. Yeah, it's pretty amazing, right? Arraez and Segura. In theory, it was like, oh, great contact. We're good. Arraez is like a hit maven, and Gene Segura has been one of the worst players in the league. So that is kind of sums up the Marlins pretty well. But Arraez is amazing, and most importantly, the Marlins are chilling in like what? Are they still in second? They're still in second, 32-28. Really impressive.
The fish are hot.
Yeah. On Marlins, make us proud. They are doing that so far. And like, I don't know. I mean, I know their record in one run games is still completely preposterous, but like, that's fine with me. They are 16-4 in one run games, which is really special. Skip Schumacher is a magician. But they're hanging around, man. They're, 20-14 against teams under 500. Like, yeah, that's how you take care of business. That's how you hang around. I'm really impressed with the division. You know, I'm always rooting for them. I mean, they have a lot of problems, and I'm not saying they're going to win the division or even make the postseason, but like, I'm very glad they're hanging around because, they were projected to be an average team. Like, they had built a roster that was supposed to be around 80 wins, and I think they can do that. I really think that they were projected for 80 wins, but they had... The Vegas over-under was 75.5, which again is why you're just going to doubt the Marlins at all costs. But it's cool to see. They're fun to watch, and obviously it's doing this without Jazz right now. So anything else on the fighting fish?
Nope. I'm just glad they're hot. I'm glad they're good.
It's good that in the A's, when we come into the season, we'll talk about the Nats later. Worry, okay, the Nats going to be one of the worst teams in baseball again. You always know there's someone worse. So that's got to feel good. White Sox sweeping the Tigers. Liam Hendricks getting the dub on National Cancer Awareness Day. That is absolutely amazing. Jake Berger with the walk-off grand slam. I mean, there were like 500 grand slams on Sunday in the regionals. There was also Eddie Rosario. But the Jake Berger walk-off grand slam with the Len Casper voice crack on the call was absolutely tremendous. And, is that... Is the White Sox season being turned around? Now they are... Like, think about it this way. The White Sox just swept the Tigers in the beginning of June and are two games back of the Tigers. Is that what you were going to say? Is that your fun fact?
That is exactly what I was going to say. And I just have a question for you, Jordan. Over the next 3 years, would you rather be the White Sox or the Tigers if you're running the team?
This is a great question.
I would decline the offer. I would say no.
You would say you'd rather be none of them.
Yes, I pass.
You would abstain from the opportunity to vote on that poll. So that's a fascinating question because we have spent so much time deciding between Tigers and Royals because those were the two teams that appeared to be on the same rebuilding path with similar young talent, similar giant holes in their roster, and the Tigers. So that is a really interesting question because the White Sox still have so much more talent on this team. It's also worth noting that the White Sox have somehow played 4 more games. They're both at 26 wins, but the White Sox have 4 more losses. I mean, I think that, oh my God, that's a really good question, because like the White Sox might be heading towards a cliff. I still feel like they have a lot of awesome players that could help them. They could somehow turn it around and all could gel like it did in 21 and they could win, you know, make the postseason. But like Tigers might be on the trend up. I think I still got to lean White Sox slightly because it's just the White Sox or the Tigers from a pure talent standpoint are so far away. But I still feel that way even despite their record. But you can make a really, I think you can make a case for the Tigers because I trust the Tigers front office more. You said next 3 years, right?
Yes, next 3 years.
Yeah, next 3 years, I think I'm still going White Sox. If you go five, I think I flip to Detroit. Anything else on this sweep?
No, I just think it's pretty sad that the White Sox are still behind the Tigers. Yeah. I'll no disrespect to the Tigers, but a sweep is
yes,
still behind
disrespect
them.
To the Tigers. That's what he means.
That's true.
Twins 31-29. They split with the Guardians. That was our one split in the opportunity this weekend. The other opportunity we had the Astros, who could have mopped the Angels yesterday. Ohtani with a heroic double at the end to salvage a game on Sunday. So the Astros commanding 3-1 lead. 3-1 series win over that one. And then the other series wins we had, the Phillies over the Nationals. Maybe we'll talk a little bit about that later. It's June, so Kyle Schwarber's hitting a million homers. Orioles, impressive series win in San Francisco. Braves, impressive series win in Arizona because those Snakes have been playing really well. Those were close games, really good series there. And then Yankees getting a series win in Dodger Stadium. Very impressive there. Aaron Judge is a freak. He's crashing into fences. He's hitting home runs. Volpe with a big homer there. Good to see that. Still dealing with more injuries. Sounds like Cortez is going to be hurt now also. But those are two. And then the other two series wins we had were the Rockies over the Royals in possibly the least relevant series of the season. This will impact, you know, lottery odds come the end of the year. We'll look back at this series and be like, oh man, Royals dropping those two was really big for their lottery odds. But as far as teams that are, because you could say, oh, what about the A's? The A's could be historically bad. And so any game involving the A's is an important part of the 2023 season story. Colorado and Kansas City. I mean, it's weird interleague. I appreciate that. Other than that, boy, oh boy, that is one that just talk about. I can imagine you have nothing to say about that series. I know I watch very little about it, but yeah, you got anything?
No, I just want to chime in and say that I have nothing to say about that series. There's okay. Nothing exciting in any way about that series.
Well said. And then we're going to do Rays Red Sox in a second, but we also had Cubs Padres, another. We have a couple series going Friday to Monday, four gamers. Very strange. Usually, of course, if you're going to have a four game series, opportunity is going to be Thursday to Friday or Monday to Thursday. Very strange scheduling here with the Brewers in Cincinnati and the Cubs in San Diego from Friday to Monday. Cubs up 2-1 in the series in San Diego. Brewers winning the first three of their series against Cincinnati. So Brewers going for the mop on Monday night at Great American Ballpark. I mentioned Guardians and Twins had the split in their four-game series this weekend. But the last series I wanted to mention, not necessarily because the series in itself was particularly surprising, was the Rays over the Red Sox. The Rays continuing to win series. They are now up to 42-19 on the season. They are ridiculous. They are amazing. Friday was rained out. They play a doubleheader on Saturday. But yesterday gave us the highlight of the weekend, or the lowlight, depending on who you ask. This was one of the funnier Major League Baseball plays I have ever seen. You know the idea. You know what? I'm not even going to say anything. The point is that my brother David here, co-hosting this podcast with me, has not seen the play yet. And so I wanted to give David the opportunity to see the play that I am talking about. Let me set the scene for you. The Rays are leading 4-2 in the top. You have the play ready, David? You're ready to click play when I say?
Yes, I'm ready to go.
Okay, so.
I'm excited.
It is the top of the sixth. We have Corey Kluber on the mound facing one of his former teams. Yandy Diaz, the leadoff guy for the Rays, is batting in a 1-2 count with Manny Margot on first base with two outs. Okay, so the Rays already have a two-run lead. It's two strikes. And it appears that the Rays have put on a hit and run for Manny Margot at first base and Yandy Diaz in a 1-2 count. So, David, I would like you to go ahead and press play, and I would like you to narrate what you see.
That's gonna be a grounder. Oh, through the hole there into the outfield. Manny Margot. Oh, they're sending him. He's going. That's towards home plate. Cut off. Okay, and that's in the outfield. There it goes. That is a mess. And Yandy is rounding third, going home, standing up at home. That's just, you hate to see that if you're the Red Sox.
Okay,
I mean, that's just a mess.
A lot of great, just excellent little snippets here. First of all, amazing hitting by Yandy Diaz to just punch one through the right side, which was vacated because the second baseman was running to second base to cover the steal attempt from Margot. And so it makes it look like they were shifting, which of course is not allowed, but goes through the right side. And all of the problems here are rooted in center fielder Jaron Duran coming towards the ball, whereas the right fielder, who I assume was Verdugo in this case, is the one who picks it up and throws it in. Because when Duran comes in, ranges over to right field to sort of back up a very, you know, weak ground ball, what happens is that there is nobody in center field. And what that means is that when Connor Wong unleashes the ball to second base to try and get Yandy Diaz and it gets past Kike Hernandez, there is nobody in center field. And that is just an amazing thing, to have a ball that was hit 91 miles an hour. So he hit a DM, and that's Yandy. He slams it into the ground. You know, negative 21 degree launch angle. Doesn't matter. Home run, Rays. And that is
home
the nature
run.
of the Rays offense in 2023. It doesn't matter if you do everything right, they will still score. So what are your favorite parts of this play? Because it's just so funny.
I just love Yandy chugging around the bases. I mean, that's a big man right there. Mm-hmm. He is just going. He's not stopping at all. He's ready. He's ready to score.
He's great.
But yeah
great.
I mean, Jaron Duran covering the right fielder on a slow grounder out
right.
there.
Right. Questionable
call.
Maybe he thought he was going to get it, but it does seem like, now listen, is this horrible? Like, is this a total mistake by Jaron Duran? No, it's just, that is why this happened, because he wasn't standing in center field. So, and also, you know, not a great throw from Connor Wong. So that also doesn't help, but it's just great. And my favorite thing is how Emmanuel Valdez and Kike react to the ball getting by them. Like, you kind of see this, just like their head just sinks and they're just like, God damn it. Like that's just not ideal.
Oh, yeah.
Like they immediately realize like Yandy is going to score. We bungled this.
Yeah.
It's great. I love it. Oh, and then Kluber at the end. The shot of Kluber at the very end. Maybe that was only on the Red Sox. They show him. Yeah, they show
him.
The pause of Kluber and the Red Sox fans behind him just like solemnly just being like, yeah, probably not our year.
Yeah, Kluber's just thinking, where's my career gone to get to this point?
Well, also
to get to this point where,
especially because Kluber's been getting rocked all year, and he's like, I got the ground ball.
Yeah.
I did my job, and it was still a home run.
So against one of the best hitters, you get the ground ball and it's still a
sorry.
Home run.
Sucks to suck. Baseball is cruel like that. All right, those are our results from the weekend. We are now going to play a new game that is only possible with my brother David here, because as you mentioned before, David is much more into hoops than baseball. He follows baseball more than I'm sure most people, just through me. And you know, he's a podcast listener and he's on the MLB at Bat app. But what happens often is that David's following and maybe he's watching the Nats or he's tuned into something else. And he's like, who's that? Where did this person come from? And that is always a fun opportunity for me as his brother and as someone who does this for a living and is lucky enough to spend time to know all of the players, or at least try to know all of the players. And so I wanted to give David the opportunity here to give me five players that are names of players that he's seen pop up this season, for better or for worse, and allow me the opportunity to kind of tell him about him. And maybe, hopefully, that these players are also people that, you know, maybe the audience hasn't necessarily heard of. To a certain degree, but he has not told me these players yet. So these will be totally off the cuff and this will really be testing my knowledge. I have no idea how deep into the Fangraphs leaderboards, or I don't know what your process was. You want to talk about your process was for picking these players before we do this fun exercise?
Yeah, my process was a little bit of looking at Baseball Savant, looking at who's on the leaderboards that I'm not too familiar with, and just looking to see who seems like they've got an interesting profile, just with their stats, with their Baseball Savant, and just seeing if there's guys that I want to know more about.
Cool. All so right, this, so we're gonna run through these pretty quickly before we get to our guest with Jesse. But I'm excited. We'll test me. Maybe you'll find one that I don't know anything about. But this will be a fun game. And let's begin. So we got five names.
We got five.
We got five.
So I'm calling right, this. Start us I'm off. calling this. What's the deal?
How about what's his deal?
What's his deal?
What's his deal? What's his deal? That's good. All right. Start us off. Who's our first player?
All right, this first player was brought up on your funniest all-star talk. Mm. I found out he has a 100% walk rate and a 4% K rate. And this guy, Ryan Noda.
Oh, Ryan Noda. This is a great one.
So, what's his deal?
What's his deal? I'm so glad you asked. So Ryan Noda, yes, this man is doing basically exactly what he has always done. But first of all, literally, who is he? He is the first baseman for the Oakland A's, which is that's a good way to not have been heard of, right? Of course. But what Ryan Noda was, he is an interesting guy because Ryan Noda was a Rule 5 pick. So that automatically makes you interesting. He was the A's Rule 5 pick. And the reason why it was so funny is that everybody knew Ryan Noda was going to be a Rule 5 pick. I don't know if we knew for sure he was going to be with the A's, but he checked every box because what has Ryan Noda done in his career? He has raked in the minor leagues. He has drawn a ridiculous amount of walks in the minor leagues and also strikeouts, but has also hit for enough power. And because he was with the Dodgers after being traded there from Toronto a couple years back, what was the trade? He was a player to be named later for Ross Stripling. So if you remember when Ross Stripling was traded to the Blue Jays, who had drafted him in the 15th round out of the University of Cincinnati in 2017, they sent Ryan Noda because he was this guy, this first baseman, doesn't really have a position, but he draws a shit ton of walks and he's got power and he's very, very kind of money ball profile. He did it in A ball. He did it in Double A with the Dodgers, you know, 904 OPS in Tulsa in 2021, you know, 870 OPS in Triple A Oklahoma City in 2022. But there was no room for him with the Dodgers whatsoever. It was the most obvious, like some bad team was going to pick Ryan Noda and say, hey, Ryan Noda, let's see if you can hit major league pitching. And so far, he has. He's done exactly what he's done the whole time. He's hitting 230, but he's got a 390 on base, you know, and he's got, you know, 435 slugs, a little bit lower than it was in the minors, but a totally useful hitter. Is it relevant because he's on the A? Like, no, he's on the A's. He's batting second, third, fourth for the A's. No one is noticing. No one is caring. But like, I mean, if Brent Rooker goes 0-for for the next couple months, Ryan Noda might be the all-star because he has been more consistent, which is pretty crazy. But the main thing to know about him is that he's doing what he has always done, but he is doing it for the worst team in baseball, so nobody cares. But salute him. I'm glad he's gotten the chance, though. Like, this is in some ways exactly the whole point of the Rule 5, and it's cool to see him have the success.
All right, this next guy, we just saw a play featuring him. He pretty much only pulls the ball, looking at his spray chart. Mm-hmm. He's a platooning with Reese McGuire, and that is Connor Wong.
Oh, man. Connor Wong, that's a good one, too. So Connor Wong is important because he was in the Mookie Betts trade. And another guy traded by the Dodgers with Jeter Downs, yikes. Nationals prospect Jeter Downs. Yeah, go ahead.
So you're saying the Red Sox won the trade.
Yeah. That's what I'm saying.
Okay.
As we see, Alex Verdugo also was in that trade, and he's, of course, been a good player for the Red Sox. But Connor Wong, he was another one who, again, third rounder by the Dodgers, they didn't have room for him. They had Will Smith. It was very easy for them to part with Connor Wong. He was a real prospect, and his numbers were pretty good in the minors, but at no point was he like a top 100 guy. It was just like, he's a catcher and he can hit a little bit, which that goes a long way. And he played a bunch of different positions in college, but really settled on catcher once he got into pro ball. And he still played a little bit of infield. But I mean, he has been shockingly competent this year. To your point, it is a pull heavy approach. But I mean, he was looking like a third catcher, you know, who would pinch hit sometimes. And I was like, great, really? That's another part of your deal. But no, he's turned into, you know, second division starter, maybe a platoon guy, and he can certainly hit it out. I mean, yeah, to your point, it's not just that he's pulling the ball, but I imagine he's really only facing left-handers. Interesting. He's not. So it's really not really as much of a platoon. I guess it must be matchup based because he has been playing against righties a good bit, but we know what the approach is. It's to yank the ball over the green monster, and it's been working for him. And I've been surprised and I've been impressed. Again, does that make the trade any better? No, of course not. But at least he is a useful player, Connor Wong. It is nice to have a catcher who can hit a little bit.
All right. This next one, we've got a new closer.
Okay.
And this guy became the closer after Gregory Soto was traded. It's Alex Lang.
Oh, this is a really good one. So Alex Lang, I think, is going to be kind of a hot name in the next couple months, especially after the Tigers traded Gregory Soto, because Alex Lang is also a very young team-controlled reliever. And it's also worth noting he's, I believe, the guy who just gave up the grand slam to Jake Berger. but before that, he was really having a special season.
He hit a 1.11 ERA before the Grand Slam.
that's amazing.
Now it's up to like 2.5.
Yeah, Well, that's what happens when you're a reliever and you give up a Grand Slam. So that's that can happen quickly. But Alex Lang's a fun one. He was a very famous college pitcher at LSU. First round pick by the Cubs, 30th overall in 2017. And it was one of those things where pretty quickly, because of the delivery, because of the command, it was just like, I'm sorry, dude, you're going to be a reliever. And so he was starting in the early parts of his career in the minors, but eventually he was moved to the pen. And then eventually he was traded by the Cubs to the Tigers for Nick Castellanos at the deadline in 2019. So that's how they got him. And since then, they've just kind of developed him into a pretty gnarly reliever. And it's not that surprising if you watched him in college. Like, this is clearly a dude that knows how to get outs, but now his stuff has ticked up, and I haven't been surprised. He was quietly awesome last year, and the Tigers were terrible and irrelevant. But there are relievers on bad teams that you are not going to notice, and he is definitely one of them. But now, since the Tigers have been sort of good, and he's racked up 10 saves, he's interesting. So I like Alex Lang a lot. I think a lot of teams – now, listen, he's got, what, 4 or 5 more years of team control, so I don't think the Tigers are, like, rushing to trade him, but I do think he's an interesting trade candidate because teams – for some reason, teams love team-controllable relievers because I never totally understood that because the relievers are so volatile that to be like, oh, my God, we have him under team control in 2026, it's like, great, you know what he's going to be in 2026? You don't know. He doesn't know. I don't know. Acting like this just happened with the Mariners and Diego Castillo. And it's like when they traded for him, it was like, oh man, and he's under team control for 3 years. I'm like, I don't care. He's probably going to suck in 2023. Well, here we are. But Alex Lang, he's fun. He is good. And he is saving games except for on Sunday.
All right. This next one, I just have one question for you, Jordan. Is Baseball Savant a liar? Because this guy is leading MLB in ERA, and I'm just telling you to respect your elders. It's Bryce Elder.
Oh, this is a great one. This is a great one. We probably should have talked about him by now. But Bryce Elder, I love this. I love the Bryce Elder discourse. It is so funny. He is the pitching version of Luis Arraez in some senses, where you look at the Savant page and you say, how? I don't understand. The numbers are low and the colors are blue. How is he good at baseball? Well, guess what? Don't let Savant rule your life. I use it all the time. It's the best. It's an incredible resource. It's an incredible addition to our experience as baseball fans. It doesn't have to mean anything. And if anything, by the way, it should make you appreciate Bryce Elder even more. But the thing to know about Bryce Elder, who was, a reasonable prospect, he was a fifth rounder out of Texas in 2020, very mature pitchability right-hander. The ceiling is not there. But what Bryce Elder has always done is get ground balls. He always gets ground balls. And when you have good defense and you are a good team with good positioning and good defense, and you put the ball on the ground a lot, every once in a while, your ERA is going to be really low over the span of a couple months. It's really not that complicated. That is doable. And so do I think Bryce Elder's ERA will be under 2 at the end of the season? No, I don't. Do I love that Bryce Elder has managed to do this on a team with like 8 starters that we expected were going to be better than him? Yes. And you should too, because it is great. It is baseball. It is things we cannot predict. And at the very least, he's proven able to be part of the rotation, which was not a given at all for Bryce Elder, even with the success he had last year. And so that's really my takeaway with him is Is he going to keep this up forever? Probably not, because he's posting good ground ball rates. He's not posting like historic Framber Valdez level ground ball rates. He's just putting it on the ground a lot, and he's generally avoiding hard contact for the most part. But listen, enjoy the ride. It's fine. He doesn't walk people, and he puts the ball on the ground. That you will get outs if you do that with a good team and a good defense and good run support, and that's what Bryce Elder has done. Good for him.
All right, this last guy, you may have just seen his broken bat homer. And he is the definition of a big bopper. It's Luken Baker.
Yes. So Luken Baker just called up. Had you heard of Luken Baker before his, like, what did you know about? I know I could have asked you this for these other guys, but particularly for him, what did you know about him before yesterday?
I just knew he was very large, and I knew that he wasn't actually that great, but maybe he is now.
great pull. So the first thing to know about Luken Baker, listed at 6'4", 280. Well, I guess that's the first thing to know. The second thing to know is March 10th. He is a March 10th birthday. So he is joining the March 10th club with my man, Josh Van Meter. And of course, you know, Diane Vicieto, wherever he's playing now. But very exciting, because Josh Van Meter has not really torn it up this season. It's not only he's even played in the big leagues this year. So to have another March 10th in the big leagues right now makes me very happy.
Also, to be clear, that is your birthday.
Oh, thank you. David being a good host there.
Yeah.
By the way, I'm realizing your birthday, David, September 8th. You're having a pretty good season. I mean, you know, Garrett Cole has been the main one for a while. But now you got Leody Taveras tearing it up in Texas. Lars Nootbaar has really broken out. That's another September 8th. So David's going to be really big in Japan as well. But anyway, Luken Baker. What do you need to know about Luken Baker? He's enormous. We knew that. But he's been enormous the whole time. When he arrived at TCU as a freshman, it was like, that's not. Who is this person? He's not a freshman. And what he did at TCU was he hit a lot of home runs, obviously. He was one of the most feared hitters, understandably, in the Big 12. But what is so stunning to me is that he has become a pretty good hitter. And I didn't think that was going to happen, respectfully. I know he put up big numbers in the Big 12, but it was just like he was bullying all these smaller humans. That's basically what it felt like. You look up Luken Baker highlights, it's like, how is that person in college? It's impossible to fathom. And then when they drafted him, you know, they take him in the second round, which I think said a lot to what the underlying data said, because those numbers and with that kind of body and profile would not necessarily scream second rounder, just kind of screams college masher. But like he's been so good the last 2 years after having a 716 OPS in A-ball in 2019. And after that, I was like, okay, it's hard to hit in the Florida State League, but I was like, this guy's not. Like, it was fun. He's probably not going to figure it out. But what he has done is he's figured it out. And last year, he wasn't that good. He hit a lot of home runs, but his OPS was 683 in AAA. And then this year, he shows up and is just unbelievable. Last year, 21 homers in 124 games with AAA Memphis. This year, 18 homers in 54 games in AAA Memphis. And the most incredible thing is that he's somehow even bigger than he was in college. He is just, the lower half looks even bigger, and he's killing it. He's strong enough. Obviously, the strength has never been in question, and it has been absolutely delightful to watch. Is he going to save the Cardinals season? Probably not, but I am. It is awesome to see Luken Baker in the big leagues, and I wish him the best. Two hits in his major league debut on Sunday. All right. We are going to take a quick break. Thank you. That was fun, Dave. That was fun, Dave. Did you feel like you were informed?
Oh, yeah. Now I know these five guys like the back of my hand now.
You know their deal.
Yes, I know their deal.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. And when we return, it is time to talk about the Washington Nationals with Jesse Docherty of the Washington Post.
The tournament field is set. The road to Omaha has been paved. It is time for college baseball's postseason, which means you need the D1 Baseball Podcast Network on SiriusXM.
Right now on your podcast feed, hear full breakdowns on the field on the D1 Baseball Podcast, plus a special look at the SEC with Highway to Hoover, and unfiltered takes on the brackets on the Shock Factor with the big donkey himself, Stephen Shock, Jake Mintz, and me, Jordan Schusterman.
So download the D1 Baseball Podcast right now on the SXM app, available with all trials and popular plans, or wherever else you get your podcasts. All you got to do is search D1 Baseball.
And welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. We are now very excited to be joined by the Washington Post's very own Jesse Dougherty. Jesse, coming to us live from the WashPo newsroom, it appears. He does work for a newspaper, folks, and he's here on this podcast. Hi, Jesse. How are you this morning?
I feel like Michael Wilbon, when he's like has like his PTI background, like the Arizona desert. Mine's just like DC office space. It's not as exciting.
No, it's good. It really kind of sets the scene up here for a story that you have covered very, very well over the last 4 years. And that is the, to call it a saga is almost not even really fair. It's a saga, but it's really just sad. We're putting the sad in saga. Replace the G with the D. That is what we are talking about. And that is Steven Strasburg. You gave us an update over the past couple of days, writing about how Steven Strasburg has once again been shut down from baseball activity. And what we wanted to do is bring you on to kind of talk about how we got here and where we go from here. But also, instead of just getting super sad on this Monday Barbacast, kind of celebrate what was truly an iconic career. Singularly, are we saying for sure that he is never going to pitch again? I won't say that, but it seems like he's getting closer to saying that. So let's start it off with a very simple question. This latest update, how did, you know, without revealing your sources, like where are we at here with Steven Strasburg? If you have not seen Steven's or Jesse's latest story, where are we at with Steven Strasburg?
Yeah, so he did not participate in spring training at all. He stayed home. So that's like bullet point one of this season. He had tried three times this winter to ramp up, threw some bullpens, felt the sort of same tingling numbness, odd sensations in his right side and his hand that he did last summer when he tried to come back. So that led to him missing spring training. April comes around. He tries again to ramp up for about 10 days. It doesn't work. He starts doing lower body exercises to kind of just like stay in shape. You hear that a lot with like pitchers who have Tommy John, like, oh, I can still go on the bike or I can still leg lift or whatever it is. In this case, like the nerve damage he's experiencing, which in the story is referred to as severe nerve damage, which is not my words. That's sourced to multiple people who are, I mean, this is such a newspaper language, but familiar with the situation. And even the lower body exercises were irritating that nerve damage. And I'm not exactly sure, like, if it irritates the nerve damage and nerve damage irritates him. But, you know, it flared up. So he has been shut down since the last week of April. We're now in the first week of June. So that's ostensibly 5 to 6 weeks. Mm-hmm. And he is not doing anything. And what I've heard is that the hope now is that a lot of rest will potentially calm down the nerve damage to the point he can try again. But what I've been writing and what his teammates have been saying and coaches have been saying ever since this saga, sad saga began, is like eventually there's going to come a point where, and we're actually probably already past it, like he could continue to affect his long-term well-being. And, you know, we're talking about like using his right hand to grip a steering wheel or open a door or lift his children. Like, if he's not, this is, and it's like, it's not our job to retire people, like, right? Like people go out on their own terms, but like, I think there is a fair discussion here to be like, he probably feels as if he owes himself, maybe the fans, maybe the organization another shot. Mm-hmm. But I think the doctors will only tell him he can keep going to the best of their ability if they don't believe he will like demonstrably affect himself more than he already has. Like there already is long-term damage done, but now it's a matter of limiting that to the best of their ability. So that's the state of play at the moment.
Yeah. And obviously all that is very sad and very bleak. And part of it though is, and people say, oh, he's making $35 million, whatever, but that feels like a very relevant part of this story. And I'm curious, one of my biggest questions, before I want to go back to the signing initially, which I want to review a little bit more directly, is like you said, it does feel like he owes it to himself. I'm not saying he doesn't want to pitch anymore or he hasn't wanted to pitch anymore. Of course, this has been his life. He's Steven Strasburg. Like that's what he does, right? But it does feel like that burden is even further, regardless of the Nationals' contention window, to just try because he has made 7 starts, you know, in 3 years, now going to be 4 years since he signed that giant contract. And like, do you sense that this is the kind of injury that maybe would have retired him or he would have decided to hang it up, you know, a couple years ago if this was not part of in some weird world where he was under contract through 2020. One, right? And then he was a free agent. Like it feels like this is the kind of thing where it's like a lot of it is screaming, hey dude, you know, the time has come.
Well, if he doesn't have the opt out in his original deal, it actually would have happened that way. Hmm. You know, he's able to opt out for the World Series and get this deal anyway. So it's not even that crazy point. World, right?
How long was I forgot? I completely forgot about that part.
Off the top of my head, I know this, but I'm not off the top of my head, I don't know how many years left, but it wasn't seven. Yeah, right. So like, it's not even that crazy of an alternate reality, right? Yeah. Actually, it's like pretty, it's right there. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, so I talked to him last September. It's the only interview he's really done since his surgery, and the only, not since his surgery, but since his latest setback. And the most detail he's been about his feelings and the procedure. We talked for about 45 minutes. And also, it's worth saying, like, Steven Strasburg, famously private, famously shy, famously media averse. Like, I'll just say it, like, just not really interested in doing the whole song and dance with us. I did ask him about the contract, and I think it's like easy to say this publicly. I will say, like, he was really candid for the interview, so I don't want to like assume this one part was disingenuous, but like what he said was he more like thinks like he wants to pitch for him and not for his contract. Like, he does not feel as if he needs to prove anything. He knows he earned that with what he did, and then you can argue that, but like he knows like he got that deal for a reason, because he was at the peak of his career when he was able to hit free agency with that opt-out. So I think like it is more like internal motivation. Like, it is more like knowing you have this finite window of time in your life as a professional athlete to compete. And if he's not going to do everything he can to compete within that window while he's also under contract, I'm like, what are we doing? But I didn't sense that like the contract or like the dollar figures were like heavily weighing on him. But again, like, you might not admit that, right? Sure. That's a big thing to admit. So I don't know.
Totally. And the last thing before I want to turn this a little bit more celebratory, again, we're not trying to retire him, but I don't want this to just be a sad conversation, because Steven Strasburg is a very important baseball person to a lot of people, including to me as someone who was at his debut and grew up in the DC area. Like, there's a lot of, you know, things I associate with him, but I want to go back to when he opted out and he signed that contract, because especially coming off this past winter, where so much of conversation was about physicals, right? With Correa, with DeGrom, and how different teams identify different fit. This is true in the draft. We talk about Kumar Rocker. Like, this is a thing that we talked about a lot. But I remember those winter meetings, right before COVID, and that Boris bonanza of Rendon and Cole and Strasburg in like 2 days, right, at the winter meetings. It was complete madness. And all of that just kind of shrouded, one, what was obviously a huge decision for the Nationals, but I want to focus on the medical, physical element to it, because he was coming off a season where he led all of baseball in innings. And when we talk about, it's absolutely nuts. And when we talk about his extensive injury history before this big contract, of course, we're referring to earlier in his career with Tommy John. And he had a couple times, but you know, he was decently durable for a starting pitcher. Like, it wasn't that crazy. And of course, in that 2019 season, he leads the league in innings and then throws a bunch in October. And we know that that's a part of the story. But I want to rewind and help you remind us, were there discussions? We know that there's always risk in signing long-term deals with pitchers, obviously. But to me, I don't remember it being that far out of the ordinary than the basic, well, 7 years, that's a lot of money for a pitcher, in the same way we were saying, wow, it's 9 years, that's a lot of year for Gerrit Cole. Right. Was there more concerns at the time? I that's what I would like to help you remind us.
Yeah, to be totally honest, like I even think about like my own reporting on this at the time. Like, it's a good chance to reflect on that a bit. Not that anyone cares about us and our notebooks, but like, I think I was covering them in that way in some degree because of the World Series. Like, it was like such like a like post-glow haze that like it was almost like, of course you give the MVP money, the homegrown MVP money, like, and keep him here. But like, an actually like good business decision is to not, right? And like, the whole discussion was like Rendon or Strasburg, like these two World Series heroes. Like, the best answer is like throw the boat at Gerrit Cole, right? If you want to like keep your competitive window open, like that was the answer. Or try and get Josh Donaldson so you don't end up with Carter, keep him at third base. Like, whatever it was, like, but I think we were like so like World Series pilled, you know? And that,
which,
I'm not saying,
how could we not be?
Right. And I'm not saying it was like we weren't being like critical or discerning, but I think it was like almost just like foregone they would bring him back. You know, like, I know he like had meetings with a few teams in Southern California. Like, I didn't ever really assume that meant anything. Like, I just knew that like they're like, I remember Mark Lerner went on TV and said they only have room on their books for one player, one of those two players. Well, okay. Then like, it's Strasburg. Like, there was just never a doubt. Like, I didn't, when like, it's like when the John Heyman tweet came out or whoever, like Strasburg to Nationals, it was almost like, yeah, sure. Like, we know, like, and that's, but you're right. Like, that's not how you do baseball business. like, right. Or for that matter, report on baseball, but it never even like really felt like there was any other way.
Yeah.
I probably sound really silly, but I think that is like the best I can describe like how my headspace and like the town's headspace at that time.
So David, I want to throw it to you here because as a Nationals fan who watched that run, and you had as a straight fan, you had no responsibility. I don't really remember where you were at then. I know that as Jesse kind of laid out there, it was a Rendon or Strasburg thing, but I do think most people thought it was going to be Strasburg for a lot of reasons. Now, had they signed Rendon, would they be in a very different place than they are now? I mean, I guess maybe slightly, but probably not that different. But David, do you remember what you felt in terms of which one you wanted back or how excited you were about Strasburg back? Like,
I mean, I wanted them to run it back. I wanted the exact same roster, run it back fully. But I knew that was unrealistic. So I think Strasburg was really the one that I was keyed into. And you know, it was a great feeling when they signed him, even though it felt really likely that it was going to happen. Still felt good when it happened.
Yeah. Well, and also like I remember feeling too. It was like, yes, it was foregone, but you also felt that we knew we just watched the peak. Like there was no version where. Of everything, not just with him in particular, but he was such a big part of that. And I think that's where I want to spin it a little bit now before we just say, all right, well, this was been a disaster. This is really sad. This is really bleak. I'm curious for you, Jesse, in the entirety of covering Strasburg, like that run, 2017, what he did in 2017, which I feel like is completely glossed over because they didn't go as much of a run. Like when you were watching Strasburg as part, because I know you were not there, of course, in 2010. We're coming up on the anniversary of his debut, June 8th. Which David and I were lucky enough to be in attendance for. And I don't know if you have any memories of that, Jesse. I know you weren't growing up in the area, but I don't know if you remember anything about that.
Watched it for sure. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But I'm curious for you, Jesse, over the course of your career, what was it like covering Steven Strasburg, the pitcher? Like, as you mentioned, media wise, he wasn't necessarily always going to be giving you the most. But let's just help remind people who like what it was really like, not just that debut, but when he was healthy and when he was dominant.
Yeah. So like the biggest thing, and this predates my time at the Washington Post or covering baseball, but like I don't think, and I could be wrong, that we'll ever experience a prospect hype to the level Steven Strasburg did when he came up. Like there's, I always remember this detail. Albert Chen followed him for a bit for a Sports Illustrated cover story right away, almost like 3 weeks into his career. And it was like, he had this scene where it was like four deep watching his pregame bullpen session. And then he's like in Cleveland, like it's not even at Nationals Park. Like, Guardians fans are like lining up to watch this guy warm up 40 minutes before a start. Like that doesn't happen anymore in baseball. Like maybe Otani, but like, you know, right now, like it's very relevant to the Nationals, but like Paul Skenes is being regarded as the next Garrett Cole, Steven Strasburg type starter. There's no way that's going to happen. There will not be people flocking to see him pitch in whatever small town minor league he starts in. Like it was such a distinct thing.
And
like Steven Strasburg.
It was a distinct thing. And for the Nationals who suck, like right. It was like, right. That was part of it too, that it was like, why is anyone caring about this guy on this team? But that's right. What it was. That's what it was. But zooming right. ahead, you're right. The hype at the time, you're right. There was nothing, as you said, that predates it. But when you are covering them, that's 17, of course, in 19, Steven Strasburg, the pitcher, what like stood out to you the most?
Yeah. Well, so the thing about like thinking his peak had been hit, like I get that. And I think I probably felt similarly. The one pushback I would have is like, he wasn't throwing like 98, 99 in the World Series run. And like,
that's true.
So the reason why I thought maybe he had like a second life is because he already had like learned to kind of be like 92, 93. His changeup obviously is like one of the filthiest pitches probably ever. Like I just like, I kind of thought, and maybe again, this is like World Series brain, like 7-235, whatever. Like we could get into like a whole like labor contract conversation, but like, is that smart? Probably not. But like, did I think he could be like an effective number two starter for another 3 or 4 years? Like, yeah, I thought so. And like, that's a person you need on your baseball team. Yeah. And when they're homegrown, you do pay a little bit more than you might if there's some guy off the free agent, just some guy, you know? So I don't know. Watching him pitch, like I've never covered 98 with the crazy curveball, like science lab pitching guy. I covered like methodical, like bottom of the zone, dart 92 mile per hour fastballs with a changeup that like fell off the face of the earth. Like that's what I covered. So like, I don't want to call him crafty. Like that's probably like oversimplifying it, but I covered like the version of him that was like, I know how to do this better than anybody else.
Yeah. And he was, oh, totally. And I think, It was like a subtle combination of the stuff was still really good, but like you said, because he was known for the velo early on, that had obviously long been gone. but never was hit hard. It's really that simple, right? Allowed very few homers. The walks were always down. Like, he was just in command. And when the postseason came, especially in 17, the strikeouts were piling up. Like, eventually the strikeouts were generally there, even if he wasn't like overpowering you. And that's because the arsenal had become so deep. And that's really what made him so special. And I know, I guess in 17, he finished third in Cy Young, you know, fifth in 2019, but like that 19 run and just everything in the postseason. Like, I had honestly, and you're going to be like, you dumbass, forgotten that he pitched in the wildcard game against the Braves. Which I know that's like the game.
I mean, I guess that's, no. I mean, game six of the World Series is pretty good too.
Yeah,
like going eight in the third, or yeah, like that's not bad.
Because in my head, it's just like Max Scherzer gets shelled, and then Juan Soto gets the hit, and then Huddy closes it out. It's like that. But obviously, he's a reason they stayed in that game. And that performance and a couple other, right, you know, in relief, like there were so many versions of all, it's an unbelievable postseason resume, even in a small sample. But to your point, I do think it wasn't necessarily about, when I say he peaked, yes, I think, right, you could argue it both ways. It's not that I didn't think he could still be a good pitcher, but it is also a good reminder of just like, pitching is dangerous. Pitching, these kinds of injuries that we're talking about now with nerve damage and stuff, it's like that happens to pitchers sometimes, but it doesn't usually happen to the highest paid pitcher who is the most famous pitcher, who is always saying. These stories do happen to guys that you never hear about, who are pitching an A ball and they get hurt and they literally cannot do things anymore and you never hear about them anymore, right? That does happen. This is not like just a Tommy John, oh, it doesn't come back. Like, these things are happening. But to have this happen in this very specific case is obviously very sad, but is also just makes the story all the more stunning to kind of follow.
Yeah. And just to add to the lore too, like, cause we're kind of unpacking that, like him taking the ball in the wild card game out of the pen sets the tone for a month of Patrick Corbin and Max Scherzer, like begging for the ball on their side days, and basically allows Dave Martinez to shrink his staff to six pitchers and win a World Series. Like,
which you're not supposed to be able to do that in the major
leagues.
In college, when coaches really don't care and really don't trust anybody and you don't have that many games to play, you see that. And when guys go into Omaha, it's like, great, our staff is five guys now. We only need to win five or six games. Great. Should not be possible in the major leagues.
Should not be possible. But I do think that because he's not like the sort of media presence that Scherzer is, or like the sort of like fun guy in the dugout, like he maybe doesn't quite get like the credit for like influence on the staff or the clubhouse, but like the action of doing that, like I think made those guys be like, all right, I'm up next. Like Steven did it. And like, now we have to, like, so I think like that is really important to like his legacy, because he probably doesn't get credit for things of that nature. He also probably doesn't get credit for like how smart he is at pitching. Like, we know, we can see it, but he's not like, you know, breaking down his spin rates and his arsenal and what he does against lefties and righties and bat path. Like, but he's certainly thinking it. And from everything I've heard, he's like a pitching genius, but he's just not necessarily like out in front sharing it. Like, I have said like my like wish on the beat, like if I had like my like genie, like one wish would be like a just entirely like open, candid discussion with Steven Strasburg about like how he approaches pitching. Mm-hmm. And like, that will never happen. Like, he just, it's not what he really, maybe post-career, I don't know. But like, I've tried and like failed to get inside his head. And like, I think that's like up there with like the unattainable things I would like wish for if I could have.
Yeah. And again, it's just like, duh. And I know there's some people that maybe get tired of hearing about 2019 Nationals because it is such an iconic team in so many ways. But yeah, Strasburg threw 36 innings in October.
I mean, that's crazy. It's crazy. And does probably contribute to like what happens next. I mean, I think it's the cumulative wear and tear on his arm over years, and trying to recover from TOS with multiple surgeries on a similar part of your body is like, don't try that at home. Like, it's not what you want to do. But it can't help that he obviously just basically maxed out to win the World Series.
Yeah. Yeah. But again, to your saying, it is part of the lore. Let us spin this forward a little bit here. Because now we're not going to recap how the Nationals got to where they are now in general. But they are, as with Strasburg as their highest paid player, David, I think, has a good question here about someone else on the roster that is also a big part of the story before we talk about the Nationals ahead.
someone else who has also fallen off a cliff, unfortunately, since 2019 for very different reasons. He has been pitching, much to the chagrin of everyone besides his paycheck. Patrick Corbin. He's not been great over the last few years, to put it lightly, but over his last nine starts has put up a decent 4.2 ERA. Do you think that Patrick Corbin is getting back to being, you know, a solid major league pitcher again, or is this just a flash in the pan and he's past his expiring date?
Running the family, you're just like take slinging out here.
That's what we do. We train him up. Well.
I mean, I think he's definitely better. He's a pitch to contact pitcher now, which works a lot better when you have a serviceable defense behind you. The Nationals actually had a pretty bad May on defense, but like last year's deep middle infield of Mikel Franco, Luis Garcia at shortstop, way out of position, was like bad for Patrick Corbin in every way. Like bad for the 2022 version of him, because in 2019, maybe he papers over that with some more strikeouts and swing and miss. Now he's basically pitched to contact. I think what he's done this year that's helped him improve, I mean, I think he had a run earlier in the season of like five straight, six inning, two earned run starts, which like, you know, if you told someone that like in the last two seasons, you'd say no way, that there's no way that happens. I think he sort of accepted that that's what he is now. I think like he was trying to get like swing and miss a lot in recent years, and the walks were really, really bad. And I think the combination of high walk rate plus high contact rate plus high hard hit rate, that's a tough one, is bad. I mean, that's just like, that is like throwing, you know, a match on gasoline. So yeah, he's changed a bit. I think he's serviceable. And then the big question is, can they move him at the deadline potentially? Because teams do need arms. And like, he could be a swing arm out of the bullpen. He is left-handed. Like, it's not insane.
It's also, Corbin is fascinating because it's like, right, so you have Strasburg. So who have the two highest paid players been for the Nationals since they won? You have, not counting Juan Soto, you have Strasburg, who has made seven starts. You have Corbin, who has made every start. He has been arguably one of the most durable pitchers in the entire league, despite throwing more sliders than almost any pitcher, right? And yet he's been horrible. He's been the worst pitcher, been the worst starter in baseball for the last 2 years. But now, to your point, that durability is attractive. And if you think you can get any matter of competence at the bottom of rotation as a lefty, yeah, it's a career low strikeout rate, and the stuff is not anywhere close. Still, you know, his FIP is somehow worse this year than it was last year, which is kind of funny, barely. Yeah. But yeah, I think that is an interesting part. But at the same time, to your point, like, when we look at the Strasburg and Corbin, do you know who the third highest paid player is? I think it's Trevor Williams. I don't even know who's fourth, or maybe Candelario. I think Candelario. Yeah. Highest.
I believe it's Trevor Williams, $6.5 million to Candelario's $5 million.
Yeah. And Candelario has been good. And obviously we'll see what they can do at the deadline with those guys. But let's end on a positive note here. Okay. The Nationals are not very good this year, but another story you wrote recently was about James Wood. And James Wood is a delight, not just a delightful baseball reference page to look at where it's like, wow, it's a young prospect who's hitting really well. Now he's in Double A. He just torched Bowie for a weekend and here he comes, right? But James Wood represents a very exciting, like, he is more than any of the young players that are on the major league roster. He is the guy that he is the shining light, I feel like, at this stage. You just wrote about him. Would you agree with that? And for people that are not familiar with James Wood, give us the pitch and why he is, I think, the center of anything involving the Nationals for the next 5 years.
So he's 6'6" outfielder who they received in the Juan Soto trade. Immediately, sources on both sides of that trade were like, this is the guy that like they did not want to give up, which, like, you know, that's a pretty good label. Like, you're the guy in the trade that they didn't want to part with. I mean, I'm sure they didn't love parting with Mackenzie Gore, Robert Hassel, CJ Abrams, Harlene Susanna, but like Wood was like, man, you know, got to send him to get this trade done. So obviously he's going to be like, compared to Soto, left-handed hitting corner outfielder, expected to sort of fill that power vacuum that they've had star vacuum they've had. It's probably unfair, right? I mean, like, Juan Soto is Juan Soto, but let's look at the ellipsis before that, but I was going to end that thought, but he's very good. Like, he is very good and he has not missed a beat in Double A. His strikeout rate is higher than expected this season, I'd say. Like, one of the more remarkable things about his rise is he left IMG and then cut his strikeout rate in half in his first season in affiliated baseball. It's supposed to go the other way. typically, like you get, it gets harder at the next level. So that was really impressive. And so he's striking out a lot. I know he's super selective at the plate, kind of has a little bit of Soto in him in that way, like takes some close strikes for called strike threes. But yeah, man, he's good. Like that's my pitch. Like he's really good.
And I think that, again, any comparisons to Soto are unfair, but you need, and you got to see him. You need to see him. Like there's no, there is, it is a very unique, it's not just, oh, he's tall. Well, we have a bunch of tall players now, you know,
yeah.
He is a uniquely shaped. He moves in a very unique way that makes you want to go watch. Not like, oh, he has a 138 WRC plus. I need to go down to the ballpark. No, look at him. That's why you need to go down to the ballpark, because he does things in a way that is very unlike almost any other player that we have.
Yeah, that's interesting too, because I always felt that about Soto. Like whether it was like the box theatrics with the shuffle and whatnot. Like, but like, and this is probably a discussion for another podcast that I will not be invited on. But like, it's hard to be a baseball player who like demands like a ticket purchase. Yes, like exactly. Right? Like you go for the hot dog, you go to watch your team. But like, not a lot of players like look unique enough in their baseball playing to like justify the price of admission, right? Like, you know your favorite NBA player is going to get X amount of touches and control the game. You know the quarterback you want to watch is going to be on under center every. But like the guys get 4 at-bats and 3 plays in the field. Like you're relevant for like 2 minutes of a 3-hour baseball game. Like, sorry, to 2:38, whatever the new time is. But I agree. Like he fits that bill in a way like not a lot of players do. I actually kind of felt that way about Trey Turner, but that's like, and that's a whole other decide. But like, yeah, he's in that mold, I think.
Yeah, and I think that's what is so exciting. But I do think brighter days are ahead for the Nationals. There's a ton of other huge questions about the ownership and about the front office and about
their view. Yeah.
Listen, like as you said, if I still lived in DC, we'd be having these conversations every day. I miss you dearly, Jesse. But you know, we will have to save it for our text thread. But thank you for taking us on this journey. We encourage everyone to go support Jesse's work and everything they do. Jesse, of course, Andrew Golden, Chelsea James, Washington Post crew is so freaking strong, and we can't recommend them enough. But thank you for joining us. And whatever happens with Strasburg, it will be a career unlike anything we have ever seen. And we will salute him forever. So Jesse, if you have anything else to plug, please go ahead, and then we'll let you go.
No MySpace or
no
Dat Pit for anything. I'm good.
That's good. Yeah. That's good. Well, you wrote a book though.
Buzzsaw. If you didn't get enough 2019 Nats talk on this podcast, it could maybe fill your itch, scratch your itch. So yeah, yeah. Buzzsaw. 2019 Nats.
Yeah, Adam Eaton was on that team, so you can go check that out. Thank you, thank you, Jesse. We'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, Jesse.
And welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. Thank you to Jesse Dougherty for joining us. Enjoyed that conversation about Strasburg. David, does that make you feel any better or worse about the Nationals?
You know, it gives me some hope that there's room for growth in the future with James Wood. I think he'll lead the way to the next great Nationals teams.
2029 Nats.
2029, right. Yes, exactly. 10 years yeah. Later.
It'll be perfect.
They'll be back in the World Series.
Yeah. But, you know, David is a big part of that. For those of you who supported us during that season when we were on a changeup on DAZN, we had David on early in the season when the Nats were really bad. And David guaranteed a Nationals World Series. It's still one of my favorite clips ever. So that's certainly what I associate David with now in terms of his fandom. But the other thing that I wanted to close with, because, again, I don't know when David's going to be on the show again, is to talk about his favorite player, Daniel Vogelbach. Daniel Vogelbach has been David's favorite player since basically Daniel Vogelbach has been in pro ball. So back to, 2012, when you were 10 and you were playing baseball. And explain to us why Vogie has long been your favorite player, and then we can talk about what Vogie is now.
Vogie has long been my favorite player for many reasons, the biggest of which is that me and 18-year-old, 20-year-old Daniel Vogelbach had a very similar look and play style. Now I have a baseball card of Daniel Vogelbach that looks very similar to me in terms of stature. Obviously, I was about 12 at the time, but I was a bit of a chonk, and Daniel was also quite the hefty.
Well, he
hefty
was then,
lad.
And he still is now. Yep.
Still is now. Yeah. I have slimmed down. He has not, and that's okay. He's still in the majors, so it's working for him.
But the key is, though, is that both in the minors and what is he is now, some people are getting frustrated by now among Mets fans, is that Daniel Vogelbach does not swing the bat ever. And he has the lowest swing rate in baseball 2 years running. He goes up there, and while you think about, okay, well, he's the big guy, he's going to hit the home runs. Only two homers this year, but he still gets on base because he knows you fools can't throw strikes. And you especially appreciated this strategy, right, David?
Yes, in my illustrious 11-year rec baseball career, I was an OBP machine. Mm-hmm. And that is because of one thing. I did not swing very much. And pitchers in rec league baseball between the ages of 9 and 16 are not great at throwing strikes. And if they're not great at throwing strikes, that means I'm getting on base. Now, another thing I have in common with Daniel Vogelbach is that we are not very fast. Mm-hmm. So it's not like we're a stolen base threat. But I get on base, and that's what matters.
Mm-hmm. And that is Vogie. And I know they did that commercial with MLB about him, you know, stealing a base with the new rules. That has not happened yet, which is a little disappointing considering how often he is reaching first base. We hope to see that change in the near future. But all you Mets fans frustrated, oh, this guy, all he does is go up there and take pitches. There are worse hitters. There are worse hitters. It is that simple. We will always root for Vogie. He's an awesome guy, awesome teammate. Is he fun to watch take pitches? That can be debated. But the point is that David will always love him. My favorite thing is I got Vogie to sign a glove when he was in A-ball. A thing that still David has. A signed Daniel Vogelbach glove, not a bat, which is way better. I guess he certainly isn't playing a lot of defense anymore. But yes, any final thoughts, David, before we say goodbye?
When you say people don't like to watch him take pitches, I just bring up the meme of the guy that goes, "She is very gorgeous to me." And that's me. That's me watching Daniel Vogelbach take six pitches in a row.
He is very gorgeous to me. That is fantastic. That's a good place to end. Thank you, David, for joining me on this Barbacast journey. Thank you to Jesse Docherty for joining us and talking to us about all things Strasburg and the Nationals. You can email us at baseballbarbacast@gmail.com. We will hopefully have a couple more email shows in the near future. Jake will be in France for the remainder of the week. However, Wednesday, we have a very special episode that Jake will be on, pre-recorded with a very special interview. I'm not going to spoil it, but you're going to be like, wow, that will be very interesting. So stay tuned for Wednesday. Jake will be on that show. Friday, I will probably have another special guest host, so stay tuned for that. But thank you all for supporting us. Thank you all for listening. And David, take us out with a go Nats.
Go Nats, baby.
SiriusXM Podcasts.